Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Thriller Crypto Season 4. Today, we are talking crypto industry seeking PPP loans. We got Dogecoin hitting the highest price since 2018. And then finally, in the main topic, we're talking to Peter Harrigan, and we're going to be discussing Bitcoin in this post-COVID world. That's right. How much has changed? Well, we're going to dive into it through crypto starting now. Gentlemen, boys and girls from around the world, it's time for Thriller Crypto. That's right. Today is July 12, 2020, and we are talking all sorts of stuff, but let's dive into PPP loans. I don't know why I'm laughing every time I say that. Well, it looks like LedgerX, Consensus, Tendermint are among all the crypto firms named in Donald Trump's admin's payroll relief program data publication. And this is all from here just recently leaked. I don't know if it was leaked. I guess it was just kind of sent out there about the payroll protection program on Monday. And all the data revealed a number of firms in the crypto and digital asset space, which was surprising to a lot of people because there was back and forth on crypto Twitter about should they have taken money, should they have not taken the money. And most of the loan recipients this week were following continued requests to do so. So this data dump includes a dollar value range for each loan, and it showed that some of them received as much as $3 million to $5 million. Consensus had $5 million. You had Tendermint with $1 million, LedgerX, Ledger Holdings, $350,000. So it's all over the place. You even have my crypto wallet, got $350,000. My Ether wallet got $350,000. Abra got $1 million. And you can go down the list. Electric Coin Company, which is Zcash, right? Foundation, they got $1 million. So a lot of people are like saying, like, why couldn't they just, you know, sell some of their coins? You would think, right? You would think. But they decided to take the free money from the government. And so a lot of people are arguing back and forth. And what's interesting is that most notably, Signature Bank was one of the most popular among these industry firms seeking PPP loans. So if you look at the data from this coming from the Block, U.S. government's payroll protection program reveals that two crypto-friendly banks were the most popular among these seeking such loans. So the Block did this research, found out that Signature Bank and Silicon Valley Bank, both of which maintain a range of crypto industry firms as clients, facilitated 9 and 8 loans respectively. According to the Block's research data, this included nearly 70 crypto firms gleaned from the U.S. Department of the Treasury's release last week. And it's also showing that data includes derivatives platforms like LedgerX, development firm like Tendermint, Consensus, which is an Ethereum blockchain studio. And this, it's funny, too, because even the Block even applied for a PPP loan and they got it. So I think if the people that are reporting the PPP loans are also participating in the PPP loans, it's like, man, everybody's double dipping in this thing. It's just interesting to me that you have, you know, especially like something like the Zcash Foundation, right? The Electric Coin Company, like, you have tons. I mean, that's what that pre-mine was for. So it, to me, it's just kind of like, why wouldn't you use that? Even IOHK, right? Charles went on Twitter and was arguing with people about how, you know, he pays taxes, he deserves that loan. And I think majority of the space realize that, but we're just kind of left wondering, like, but you have all these... You have all these tokens, be like Ripple, sell every quarter. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know why that wasn't the first thing you would go for, but to each their own. Maybe they're buying more Bitcoin with it. Who knows? The next piece of news we have is Dogecoin is hitting its highest price since 2018. And this is all from a viral TikTok video that took this kind of meme coin all the way up 43%. So it started, I want to say, what was it like? It was a weird day. It was Tuesday. And then by Wednesday, it experienced its largest pump ever, up 43%, right? And these TikTokers were able to get it from 0.002 tenths of a cent to 0.005 tenths of a cent, so half a cent. And then it finally cooled off and everybody dumped on them. But not only are these TikTokers like 12, 13, 14 years old that were posting these videos, but they also were talking about how this is cryptocurrency. I was watching some of the videos. I was like, wow, they actually know what cryptocurrency is. And they were saying it's like Bitcoin, but it's cheaper. Like, you kept hearing that over and over and over again. So it was pretty fascinating to see these TikTokers get involved in cryptocurrency this week. But it just goes to show you, Robinhood is a gateway drug for these young kids who want to get involved in investing, which is crazy. You know, at 12, 13, 14, I wasn't thinking about investing. I was thinking about Halo, right? Or eating pizza or something. And so it's just kind of funny how they're like, yeah, let's make Dogecoin climb up. And pretty fascinating. Next piece of news we have is Jay-Z. Back startup is helping Ethereum developers build more. So Alchemy has released their Alchemy Build Suite. And if you have never heard of Alchemy, you wouldn't be the only one saying this. It's basically Ethereum dApp Studio. And they have, I guess, backers like Jay-Z and Will Smith amongst its investors. And they announced today that they're going to be able to build a new suite of tools on top of Alchemy's existing platform. It's designed to reduce the amount of time blockchain developers spend on issues not related to the product itself. So that's kind of cool. But Alchemy co-founder and CEO Nikhil Viswanathan thinks Build will supercharge what's possible with the platform. And ultimately, he says, this means that developers can build products faster, which means that the users get more products and more innovation in the blockchain space as it happens overall. As you know, OpenSea is an Ethereum-based digital asset marketplace, amongst many others that have already gotten a taste of this new product suite. So it's going to be interesting to see how Alchemy kind of works around this ecosystem. And hopefully, you know, in the near future with AR glasses coming out, we'll be able to see these NFTs in real life. At least that's my hope. And then our next piece of news is Bitcoin Gold. So Bitcoin Gold, as you might not know, has stopped an extremely long block reorganization attack. And this is coming from its developer team. And according to the development team, an attacker rented hash power from mining service provider NiceHash on July 1st and secretly mined an alternative chain, essentially creating a new transaction history for the network for nearly 10 days, mining over 1,300 blocks in the process. On July 10th, the attacker released a secret chain in an attempt to collect over 8,000 Bitcoin Gold worth more than $75,000. The attacker was thwarted, however, as the Bitcoin Gold team detected the attack early on and alerted mining pools and exchanges about the potential attack. The team also privately supplied these entities with a new updated version of Bitcoin Gold network, which implemented a checkpoint at block 640,000. The most recent honest block before the attack, the new code run by pools and exchanges automatically rejected the attacker's chain when it was released on July 10th. So this is why you don't buy any other Bitcoin but Bitcoin. I don't know why you would be buying Bitcoin Gold to begin with. Maybe it's just because you have it because of the fork. But what are we doing here? Sell your Bitcoin Gold for Bitcoin like ASAP. And I think that's all. That's all the news we have. Yep, that's all of it. I mean, really, there's a lot of information going out right now about Coinbase, and we're going to talk about that here in an interesting video of the day, because Brian Armstrong, I guess you could say, is in a lot of fire here recently for defending its contract with the Secret Service. Yeah, I know. Big stuff. Let's dive into it. Interesting video of the day starting now.
Thriller podcast. Interesting crypto video of the day.
All right, so today's interesting video of the day is about Coinbase and the selling of its data to the DEA and the IRS, and it just keeps getting worse as the news comes out. We had Brian go on crypto Twitter to try to defend himself, and everybody chimed in. So take a listen. This is actually from Young and Investing, a crypto YouTuber by the name of Quentin. And he actually does a really good job of explaining this. Take a listen.
Let's first have a look at this article right here to know what it is about. So we're going to read some parts out of it to know what this is all about. So Coinbase wants to identify Bitcoin users for the DEA and the IRS. So cryptocurrency exchange Coinbase is looking to license its blockchain analytics software to two US government agencies. The first one is the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the second one is the Internal Revenue Service. I think both are very known outside the US as well, because I live, for example, in the Netherlands right now, and I do know these two government agencies very well, of course. So they are planning to buy licenses from Coinbase for cloud-based software called Coinbase Analytics. And of course, when this news came out, a lot of people started criticizing Coinbase. And the company replied with several statements. So the first thing they said is that this tool only offers them streamlined access to publicly available data, and at no point do they have access to any Coinbase internal or customer data. That's at least what the company says. Also, they added, does not include any personally identifiable information for anyone, regardless of whether or not they use Coinbase. So basically, Coinbase is defending themselves, saying that they are not selling the data, the personal data of the customers, and only selling the publicly available data. But of course, not a lot of people believe them, because of course, this is the IRS and the DEA, and they don't work together with these two government agencies just to sell them like some publicly available data. That's at least what a lot of people think. I am neutral in this, of course, because also I am not even using Coinbase, but a lot of people are saying this about the statements that the company released shortly after the criticism started. Now let's have a further look to the contract. So the first contract is with the DEA, and the DEA contract extends from April 3rd, 2020, so that is already 2 months ago, to April 2nd, 2021, so 1 year contract with the DEA. It provides investigators with identity attribution and de-anonymity's virtual currency addresses domestically and internationally. And now comes the very interesting part, because Coinbase could make anywhere from $10,000 to $250,000 on the deal, according to details in the contract. So that contract is right now, you can read it if you look it up, you can read the DEA contract, and it literally states this sum of money, this amount of money. And I find this very, very weird, because why would Coinbase sell their analytics to the DEA for only this amount of money? I mean, this is literally nothing for Coinbase. If we have a look to the revenue of Coinbase and the profit that they made in the last several years, well, the revenue was $1.3 billion in 2018 and the profit was $456 million. In 2018. Think about this number, 10,000 to 250,000. So best case scenario, 250,000. This is nothing for Coinbase. So very, very weird. And it makes me think that there is maybe something more going on, because this doesn't make any sense. Anyway, in 2019, there was a total turnover of 488 million and a profit of 146 million. So still, 250,000 is literally nothing for Coinbase. So to me, it doesn't make any sense why Coinbase is currently having these contracts with the DEA and the IRS, because also Coinbase is a company that is currently worth $8 billion. I mean, they don't need to have like 10,000 to 250,000, because they know that this will backfire. Many people are in crypto because it is against the government, it is against the banks, it is against the financial system. I get that. And also, Coinbase is a regulated exchange. This is all good. But I mean, Coinbase, they know that if they're going to sell these analytics, even if they are publicly available like they claim, they know that this is going to backfire and they don't need the money. So I don't know why they took the risk and took this little amount of money to make a contract if they know this is going to cost them a lot of money. And we're literally talking about millions of dollars, or even tens of millions of dollars, that Coinbase is going to lose because all the people leaving the platform. Anyway, let's have a look at the IRS contract as well. So the IRS contract reads that the IRS Criminal Investigation Cyber Crimes Unit requires a software tool that can assist in the tracing of various types of cryptocurrency not just the Bitcoin. The IRS contract is for one base year from the date of award with one 12-month option. So 1 year and a 12-month option as well on the IRS contract. This is publicly available, like I said, and it's very weird. Then we also have like a link with Neutrino, and Neutrino is acquired by Coinbase in February 2019 for a reported $13.5 million. And this move was also widely criticized already because of the founder's ties to a controversial surveillance technology company called Hacking Team. So this is not good for Coinbase. I don't know why they are doing it, but I think there is more going on than that we know. Because obviously they won't sell a contract for $10,000 to $250,000 to a government institution like that, knowing that if they do that, that goes against all values of cryptocurrencies and that their users would leave the platform. So what is exactly going on? We don't know.
What's fascinating is you have Jesse Powell, who's the co-founder and CEO of Kraken. And he said there was an employee that he had, this is coming from his Twitter, that he had that chose to leave and go to Chain Analysis, right? And he said that we chose not to develop this business internally, and we chose not to invest in analytic firms because I never wanted to have a conflict of interest with our clients. I didn't want to profit from selling out your financial privacy. He's talking about his Kraken users. And then he also says, is there government demand? He says, obviously, we have our internal tools that we use, but productizing those tools and selling them, driving competition and accelerating development in the anti-privacy space is at odds with our core values. How could one resist using client data to gain an edge? And then he even goes on to makes more of a statement here. And he says that not only, here it goes right here. He goes, sure, it's possible that they are buying data from their own customers. All vendors are aggregating data from multiple sources. So in-house analytics also uses data from many sources. I meant that having good tools and data doesn't mean you need to sell it. So he's saying that you could be doing this internally and that's okay. But at the same time, you don't want to be going and selling your findings out to the government, right? And I think Quentin on that video made a really good point about like, what else is kind of going on behind the scenes that we don't know? Because $250,000 is not that much money. You know, it almost seems like, you know, and you kind of see this with other big companies like Facebook and Amazon, where they just, or even Elon Musk too, where they just will do anything to get those government contracts. Right. And because they know that once you get your foot into those government contracts come and more and more and more. So I think it has more to do with them just trying to get their foot in the door with the government so that that way they can just become, you know, another type of Facebook, another type of Amazon just in the crypto industry. And that puts them in a very scary place for us all. So I hope I'm wrong about that, but that's what it looks like to me. Definitely feels that way. Okay, with that, let's get into coin talk. That's right, we got to talk about some coinage stuff all over the place today, all over the map. We got Chainlink. I think it's around like $7.50 right now. It's crazy. So let's do it. Coin talk starting now. It's time for Coin Talk. Before we dive into that, we got a couple of things to announce. So we actually are almost done with our Bitcoin audiobook. That's right. We haven't announced a date. I shared it on Twitter. I shared it on thrillerx.com. But we're gonna do it here on August 18th. So it's going to be free to the entire world. The name of the audiobook is called One Satoshi at a Time, How Bitcoin Will Change the World. Obviously, right? That's what we've been saying since the beginning, since the inception of this podcast. And it's going to be free. So far, there's going to be 14 chapters. We're going to have a special guest as for doing the forward. We're going to have an introduction. You can run through all the track listing. Head over to thrillerx.com. Check out all that stuff. We're going to be providing some private streams. So if you're a subscriber here on our premium side, you'll be getting a private stream. But or you can just wait, right? You can just wait till August 18th and it's free to download. You're gonna be able to take it with you anywhere on your phone, or you could just go to, you know, the Bandcamp website. Of course, we're gonna buy an address. I don't want to say that address right now before somebody buys it, but we're gonna buy an address, and then at that point we will we'll point you to that address, and then you can stream it on your phone, stream it online, or you can download it. It's all gonna be free. There's not gonna be any charge whatsoever. My hope for this is to help, you know, move the space forward, right? I feel like there's a lot of people that are already doing that. And I feel like we've been doing that here with this podcast, just sharing it out for free with everybody. And my hope is to, you know, allow some new coiners that have yet to enter the space, get this audiobook and then be able to understand what Bitcoin is and why it's important and how it will change the world ultimately. And I definitely think like this is easy listening. It's definitely geared more towards a younger audience, I would say. I definitely don't think an older audience can listen to it. I think they'll just get frustrated with with all the music and stuff. So if you've listened to anything that we do here on our podcast when it comes to our main topics, it's very similar. It's very in that same vein of an audiobook, right? So it's very multimedia-ish, right? So I hope you guys are excited as much as I am excited about releasing it. We have Lucio Paletti. He's going to be doing the cover art for it. You should definitely check it out. It's amazing cover art. He was able to remix one of his old art prints that he had, and this one looks just like primo. It looks amazing, and I can't believe that we just got so lucky. So it should be exciting. I think everybody is really going to enjoy it, because I've been listening to it. I had my wife listened to it too, and she was like, wow, this is really good. And I was like, thanks. Because it's one of those where you listen to and you're just like, you just fall in, and it's so easy just to listen to. So hopefully you guys enjoy it. Okay, with that, let's get into Coin Talk. But we got to roll a disclaimer, right? So let's do that now. Let's roll the disclaimer.
Remember, Thriller
Podcast does not give financial advice. He cannot have a future. Even if he just can, he is just some dude trying to save the world one Satoshi at a time. All right, it's time for Coin Talk. My favorite part of the day, your favorite part of the day, I'm sure too, right? So we're at a total market cap of 278 billion. That's right. 278 billion. Not quite alt season yet. I'm not calling it alt season. I'm still not calling it alt season. We're not there. Give it a 295 billion or maybe 300 billion. And then I'd be like, you know, we're probably there, right? But not yet. We got Bitcoin at 9,273. So pretty much a stable coin at this point. So that's great. We got Ethereum at $240. And then just a whole lot of really bad tokens here after that. I want to talk about one particular token, because we're going to talk about Bitcoin in the main topic with Peter. But I want to talk about one particular token that has kind of done a tour de force here recently. It really is in uncharted territory. What is this out here? What is this? Is this from the 80s, bro? Oh, it totally is from the 80s. Wow. Is this uncharted territory? Is this music for uncharted territory? Dang, look at those synths, bro. So I want to talk about Chainlink. I want to talk about Chainlink. Come here. Come on. Let's get that lower, bro. We're talking about Chainlink today, primarily in Coin Talk. Because it's definitely entering a danger zone here. And I don't mean like in a bad way. Well, kind of in a bad way, I guess you could say. But not really, though. It's decoupling. We're seeing a decoupling, ladies and gentlemen. That's right. It's a decoupling from Bitcoin and Ethereum. And most people don't realize that, but that's okay. That's why you list in a car through the crypto, because he tells you what most people don't see. It's, I'm not lying. It's true. So I'm thinking right now, and I might be first, but I'm definitely am thinking right now. But I think Chainlink might be the third most important cryptocurrency in our top 10, in the top 100 at this point. We had Chainlink at $7.19, went up to $7.50 today. It's at 2.7 billion market cap. It was just at 12 yesterday. And I think everything that has come out, I think everything that we have seen over the past few months with them, Sergey is probably one of the brightest minds in the space. You know, definitely is a person who skate to where the puck is going kind of person, right? Doesn't wait around. And I think what we're seeing here is Bitcoin becoming the number one project in the space, Ethereum becoming the second most important project in the space, and now Chainlink, to me, is the third most important project in the space. I think it has set itself apart from other cryptocurrencies. And now I think it's entirely can stand on its own. It's crazy to think that because it's a freaking ERC-20 token. So that to me, me saying it doesn't, I don't want to believe it, but it's, it has. And so people are always asking, where do you think the price of Chainlink is going to go? Well, you really don't even have to do, you can just do back of the napkin math here. The problem with Chainlink, and this is the problem that I've said for a year at this point, is the circulating supply, right? So it's at 350 million, not bad, right? I mean, I wish it was lower, but that's where it's at. It has a total, you know, supply of 1 billion. The other, I guess, 650 million is broken apart to the team and to, I guess, their holders. I don't know who those people are, probably the people that started the token. Anyway, the problem with that is there's no vesting schedule. So we don't know when that dump is going to happen, right? I mean, if you look something like a Ripple, we see that dump here every quarter, right? Chris Larson's like, make sure we dump that Ripple, dump that XRP. And they don't miss a date, right? They're pretty, I mean, that's one thing I will say about Ripple and XRP. Like, they're consistent on their dumps. You know, it's every quarter. This is when you're going to get the dump. This is why XRP hasn't, you know, gone anywhere during this whole, you know, whatever you want to call this cycle. But Chainlink doesn't have that. There's no vesting schedule. We don't know when that dump is going to occur. We actually jumped into Chainlink here recently on the subscription side. So you would have to go back to look at that. But long story short is the times that we have seen the dump from Chainlink, and there's times, and you can see it on chain through Coinmetrics and Glassnode. It's all there. And we have that documented in our subscription podcast. So you can go take a listen to that. But you can see that that has occurred, right? And so even with that, even with without a vesting schedule, even with, you know, there potentially being an opportunity for that company to dump on them, it still, to me, is the third most important project in the space because of all the partnerships they have. And we don't have time to go through all the partnerships, right? But I will say, and we have done that in the past, but I will say that what Sergey and team has done is a round of applause, man. And it's, I don't think I haven't seen that happen. I mean, I saw it happen with Ethereum and Bitcoin, but I've never seen that. I never thought I would see that again. Like, I never thought I would see a third project come out of nowhere and solidify itself as its own thing. And Chainlink has managed to do that. So it's going to be interesting to see how far or how high it goes up. But if I had to, if I had to give an estimate, it's real easy to see here. I mean, 2.7 billion. Do we think it could double? Yes, obviously it could double, right? So that would put it at 5 billion. That would put it at 14 bucks. Could it go any higher than that? Yeah, it could go to 10 billion. What's that? 30 bucks. You know, after 10 billion, 20 billion. What's that? 60 bucks. You know, 10 billion, you know, 20, 40. And then before you know it, you're looking at $120 token. So yes, could it go up that high? Yes, definitely $120 token. I would say the safest bet to me is somewhere around, you know, 12 to 20 bucks. That's where I would say is a safe bet for Chainlink. But in the future, definitely here in this next bull run, as everything starts accumulating in market cap, Ethereum will be it. Bitcoin, as you know, will be it. We're going to get well over $1 trillion market cap, you know, $100 trillion, you know, gets spread out pretty unevenly, right? Because Bitcoin is about 61% of that dominance. You got ETH at 9%, and then you have everything else sharing the rest of it. So yes, you could see at some point Chainlink, you know, battle Ethereum for that second spot. And that's not a far-fetched idea. And I don't think, I definitely would have never, if you had told me at the beginning of the year that was a possibility, I would have been like, no, that's crazy. What? When did that happen? But I'm starting to see that, and I'm starting to become aware of that. And I think once people start realizing that Chainlink is the third most important cryptocurrency, you're going to see the price skyrocket. And I think that's happening this past week and this week. You're starting to see institutional investors and probably hedge funds get in on VC, get in on that Chainlink right now. Because even at $7, $6, that's still a bargain, right? You got to remember, there was a point where Ethereum was $7, $6, $15, and people were still buying it, right? So yes, you could have got it at 99 cents, 75 cents. same thing goes for EOS. So that's what I'm saying. Like, Chainlink at $7 is to me still a great deal. Does it suck not being able to buy a vast majority of it here at $1.98 back in March? Yeah. Or even $5 two weeks ago. or even, you know, was it 94 cents 12 months ago? Yeah, it sucks. But that is cryptocurrency. You don't know where these projects are going to head. You don't know how this is going to play out. It's all up in the air. But they're starting to supplant their feet as the third most important project in the space. And that's kind of what I want to talk about today here in CoinTalk. I think that needs to be said, and people need to start taking notice because it's number 9 in CoinMarketCap. So it's going to work its way up here pretty soon. It's going to knock out Litecoin, and then it's going to go for BSV. So that'll put it at 7. And then Cardano, it could definitely be Cardano because Cardano is 3.9 billion. Bitcoin Cash, I think once we get Chainlink to about 5 billy, that'll put it in front of Bitcoin Cash, and then it'll be number 5. And then it just has to take out XRP, and XRP is at 8.9 billy. So yeah, it totally can be done. It could totally be at number 5 by the end of the year, Chainlink. It's crazy to think about it. But at least at this point, we actually have some solid projects in the top 10, right? And I think if you look down the list, Bitcoin's a solid project, Ethereum's a solid project. I would say Chainlink now is a solid project. It's going to take some time, but I feel like at this point, it's safe to call it the third most important project in the space right now. It's crazy how that happened. Okay, with that, let's get into the main topic. Today, we are talking Bitcoin and post-COVID world. So let's do it, main topic, starting now.
Could love you more, you got a beautiful taste. IMF just want my names.
Today's main topic on Thriller Crypto with Gar Gonzalez. Only on ThrillerX.com.
It's time for our main topic. Today we have Peter Harrigan, CEO and co-founder of Gray Swan Digital and co-founder of Sentient Technologies. Hey, what's up, Peter?
Hey, how are you doing this morning?
Pretty good. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Peter. How'd you get started? I like that you're the co-founder of two companies. So that's awesome. Tell us a little about Gray Swan Digital and Sentient Technologies.
Yeah, sure. So my background is primarily in capital markets. I've been trading for a long time, started out doing an arbitrage thing between two stock indexes back in the 80s. And so I've been a trader in Chicago, traded options on the trading floor in Chicago, and then traded them out here in San Francisco. In about 2007, I got involved in a startup, which was later Sentient Technologies. And there were about four of us. I like to call myself the least important of four founders, which was essentially an evolutionary learning algorithm. It was an AI company in terms of where we evolved short-term trading strategies. And I came in with kind of capital markets expertise, not the AI expertise, and sort of helped in terms of getting some domain expertise in around trading and in terms of some of the functions, what the goal of the actual evolution was. I was there for about 6 years, and there was a point where we kind of started realizing the technology was very powerful outside of capital markets, and they started finding some really interesting health applications and things. But at that point, you didn't really need a head of trading. So I left in 2013 and for the first time in my life, didn't need a job right away. So I had a little time to start learning about new things. And I started getting very interested in the whole blockchain space. And so I started going to some of these meetups and going to a bunch of stuff in Silicon Valley and went to kind of early Ethereum, I guess, kind of pre-sale Ethereum meetups. Nice. And some Bitcoin meetups. Just trying to, get a handle on what could be done with, what could be done with the technology. I say I got two things out of that. One was luckily participating a little bit in the pre-sale, which was just stumbling into some luck there. Obviously not anywhere big enough because you can't trade that kind of thing big enough. Yeah. It's always too small. And the other thing is I ran into my partner, Steven, and we started talking about what we could do with the tech. And that's where we sort of came up with the idea of the current company.
Nice. So Gray Swan Digital, where are you guys based out of? Is it here in the States or is it outside?
Yeah, we're out of, our team is fairly distributed, as many teams are now. But the two of us who are the, main founders are in the San Francisco area. I'm I'm physically right in the middle of San Francisco. My partner, Steven's up a little bit north of here. And then we have people in a few different locations that we're working with as well. So, I mean, that's our current physical location, although certainly that could change. And, you know, nowadays, I mean, we're going towards a world where people could be anywhere anyway. And now that's obviously been accelerated quite a bit. People are becoming quite comfortable with that, which is great for us. You know, obviously start saving some money on extremely expensive office space and things like that. So that can be very helpful.
Yeah, post-COVID, it feels like everything's kind of ramped up and changing the world. It's just changing faster. So I kind of want to get into what you see the space looking like right now as far as like just the macroeconomics of it all, the Fed. What's your opinion of what's going on right now, Peter? Because you have a lot of experience and you have, you know, well over, you know, years of experience just trading and seeing these markets just kind of go back and forth. So what's your take on everything?
Well, you know, my take on where we're going with the Fed and with, you know, our national currency is, you know, I've kind of thought there was going to be a problem with the dollar for a really long time, right? The government has huge unfunded liabilities, right? They've got liability to pay out Social Security in well in excess of the money that's going to come in, even if things work well, even if everything goes right, which I think we all now know is not really a good assumption. Additionally, there's things like Medicare, which are actually even larger. So there's this massive, there was always this kind of massive structural thing looming out there. And you had to wonder, how were they going to come up with that money? Were people always going to keep lending money to the government? And then we're just going to somehow, you know, make it through this kind of 75-year prospect where everything works well. Foreigners keep lending us money very helpfully, and then we go through that process and at the end somehow come out the other side. That never struck me as being very likely that it would work, because things can go wrong, as I guess we all know now, right? And things can go wrong on a fairly big scale. So, you know, it was a plan that if everything went perfectly, kind of seemed dangerous and kind of seemed a little sketchy. But now when things do go wrong, it seems kind of crazy. So there always seemed like there was this looming point where the Fed was going to have to print a lot of dollars, right? The government was going to issue bonds. There would be only so many buyers of those bonds. The Fed would buy the bonds and hold them and print money to buy them, which is essentially just printing money. So it seemed like that was going to happen eventually. Obviously, we've seen that accelerate very quickly. And we've seen that in response to a crisis, they don't really have any hesitation in terms of printing a lot of money. So, I mean, we've had a situation where the Fed's balance sheet almost doubled. They created a huge amount of money. They're taking some of that money back in now, but still, it's just a huge number. And throughout this sort of 2008 through 2019 period, there was a large creation of money, but most of it was just bank reserves. So it didn't necessarily get out into people's pockets and into spending. That's different now. Now we're actually seeing a fairly significant rise in the M2 money supply. So I do think that the, you know, kind of cats out of bag, genies out of bottle, whatever metaphor you want to use. But I think that money is getting out there and we're going to, you know, right now there's still a lot of demand for the dollar because of the crisis, but that's going to lag. And yeah, I think we're going to keep seeing printing.
So as far as stocks that are trading at all-time highs, and then we have kind of Bitcoin in the crypto space, just kind of just in this kind of like sideways pattern for what it's been most of the summer after the halving. We've seen DeFi take off here in the space, in the Ethereum space. Do you see much correlation between the two, between the markets and then the crypto markets, or do you kind of separate those out? I always wondered from a trader's perspective how you guys see that.
Well, I mean, there certainly seems to be a correlation right now between the U.S. stock market and the Bitcoin price. And, you know, if you do a long-term correlation, they clearly show a pretty high correlation. But, you know, they've both been going up. So, you know, you kind of wonder if that correlation is, you know, something fundamental that's underlying and will continue, or if that just happens to be a coincidence of what happened, right? So I would definitely at this point still see a correlation between the, you know, the stock market and Bitcoin. And I think that that will probably continue. I think maybe mostly just because people are, you know, when people get nervous, they're still kind of fleeing to the safety of dollars, not necessarily because they think they're safer, but maybe just because everyone else is. Right. So I think we're going to see that. I do think that correlation breaks at some point. I'm not sure what that point is. It could be, you know, it could be in place for a couple more years. But I mean, on the other hand, you know, if we do continue to see this dollar creation by the Fed, I do think stocks have, you know, they may pull back here, they may go down. I mean, who knows? But I can certainly imagine a scenario where stocks keep going up just because stocks are denominated in dollars. And if they're printing a lot of dollars, right, then there's going to be dollar earnings. Those dollar earnings may not be the same, you know, underlying value because the dollar's not worth as much, but certainly you can imagine stocks going up just because of the monetary environment.
Right. So as far as seeing Bitcoin, you know, there's Plan B out there. He's showing this Bitcoin stock to flow model. We also have, you know, the Fed printing as well too. What are you hearing out there as far as like a Bitcoin and price levels that it could reach? Are people taking this stock to flow model seriously? Like, I guess my question would be like, as far as what you're seeing and what you're hearing and who you're talking to, are they more on board with the Paul Tudor Jones fastest horse kind of theory, or are they kind of looking at Bitcoin more like, it's going to do something eventually?
Yeah, I was a little surprised that the Paul Tudor Jones thing was, I mean, this is a guy who's extremely well respected. He made a very, very solid and logical argument. I was, I guess, surprised to see how quickly that faded. But, that's the world we're in now, right? We all get excited about something, talk about it for a few days, and then something else pops up and then that, you know, fades away. I think Tudor Jones makes a ton of sense. I also think the stock to flow model, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, if you read what Plan B says about it, he's very clear. He said it's a model, right? Models are, what's the line? All models are wrong. Some models are useful. So he thinks that model will be, gives you some kind of an idea if we go into a new phase for Bitcoin, where perhaps we could go. Right. He's certainly done a lot of good work underlying it. I think the more interesting one is the cross asset model, where he kind of looks at how well that model predicts various assets that have high stock to flow. Personally, I did a little work on looking at that with regard to U.S. real estate. And just seeing if it was in any way predictive of U.S. real estate. And what I found, based on my reading of the numbers, was that his formula seemed to fit pretty well. I mean, if you looked at how much real estate exists and how much housing, to be more specific, exists in the U.S., and then how much is being created every year, you get an idea that you get a market cap for housing that seems to fit along his line pretty well. I think you could make some criticism of the housing market being a stock to flow. I mean, it was one of the original things that stock to flow is kind of for, but you know, you can make an argument that the U.S. housing market overall is just one big market. It doesn't make sense because, you know, people can't necessarily live anywhere they want. So maybe you should be looking at local markets instead. But just looking on the macro level, that model did seem to work. And I think we got a little while to figure that out, right? I think he'll consider it a failure if it hasn't worked within a year, right? So we're gonna have to wait a while to know if that one's any good.
As far as being out there in San Francisco, you're hearing not only about housing, but people are kind of leaving in droves out there. How are you guys doing out there? I feel like more and more people are coming to Austin. That's the place to be. But how is it out there in San Francisco? Is it as bad as everybody says?
Well, I mean, it's on quite a lockdown, and it feels like a permanent lockdown, right? So I was just talking to a friend who's in real estate. There's, you know, more supply relative to the number of houses that are selling, which is a bit of a shift for us. Usually we have an extremely low amount of supply, but actually there's not a lot going on. I mean, they're not that many. There's just not that much, you know, not many houses are being bought. And then obviously the same number being sold. But there are more listings. But it's just kind of quiet. I do think people are really worried about where this will go. And our governments out here have no real interest in looking at the whole picture, right? They're looking at this from a disease standpoint. How can we be perfectly 100% safe while at the same time their revenues are declining because they're not allowing any business activity? So I think, you know, if that continues, we're going to find out just how much you can get away with by locking everything down. Certainly we haven't had a lot of cases in San Francisco. We have had very few deaths. I think we're looking at something like some number in the 50s, and there's a city of almost a million people. So that's great. But at the same time, cities, tax revenue has fallen off. The state's tax revenue has fallen off. And I think people who are trying to take, who are at least trying to take a more balanced approach, like Texas, that seems like the smart move. I mean, this is a difficult thing. There is no perfect approach. But I think at least trying to balance the economic with the health and, you know, benefits seems like it's smarter. So I do kind of wonder. I mean, I'm looking at the door too, right? And thinking it might be a good time. And, you know, it's just a question of where do you move. And looking at places, Texas makes a lot of sense. You guys have a great business environment. Every time I'm there, I like it. Although I can imagine it is probably a little bit more expensive than it was last time I was there a few years.
Yeah, definitely 10 years ago, it's definitely more expensive. But it definitely feels more, it's definitely shifted from the creatives here to more of a tech kind of atmosphere, which is good because there's a lot of creatives in tech. So it definitely feels more like that, I would say, than years past, which is good for networking. Honestly, that's one of my favorite things about living in Austin is the amount of people that you meet just networking wise. And we have quite a few people in the Bitcoin space and the crypto space here in Austin now too, as well. You know, we're moving to an election year this year. Of course, Donald Trump is our president, and they're talking about, you know, providing more stimulus. We also have, I guess, Joe Biden, and then now Kanye for some strange reason. How do you see, it's such a strange world. How do you see America kind of moving on to this next, I don't even know what you would call it. It almost feels like we're making a turn here as far as giving money away and as far as paying people to stay at home. And how do you see that playing out? Because I don't even know at this point. Does anybody?
Right. I know it's a very strange situation to be in where the government says you can't go to work, and they tell businesses you can't open up and you can't generate revenue. Certainly, it only seems right that they would provide some money to people when you tell them you can't go in and make a living anymore. The thing that worries me the most about this, though, is that the result of this is there's a lot of money generation. And as usual, the people who are closest to that money generation seem to benefit from it first and most. I just read the other day that the large banks, well, I guess all the banks, but, you know, that's mostly the large ones, are expecting to make about $18 billion in revenue off of just distributing the PPP funds to small businesses or to sometimes medium or some larger businesses. So those guys, you know, that's a perfect illustration of this Cantillon effect, where the people who are closer to power and are closer to the creation of money get the greatest benefit from it. So here we have a thing where we're mailing out checks to people, we're mailing out stimulus checks, we're sending money to businesses so they can keep people employed. And then who's benefiting? Well, it's these large banks that are, you know, getting to process that money. And then a lot of people who have access to all of this money that's being created and have the first shot at buying assets before they go up. And so I just think what's going to end up happening is, even as we mail stimulus checks to people, I think we're going to end up in a situation where you know, income and net worth inequality will continue to increase, right? So ever since we went to, you know, fiat currency in 1971, broke any link between the dollar and other currencies and the dollar and gold, since that point, we've seen this huge increase, you know, continuing increase in income inequality, right? Most of these benefits have gone to the people at the top. I think that's probably what's going to end up coming out of this. And you can certainly understand why there's a certain amount of unrest. I can see why people would be upset. I mean, you're saving money and the money that you save is being undermined and you can't go to work and, things like education, which will help you become more and more expensive. You know, it's a difficult situation and you can see why people would be a little bit upset with it. So, this is of course, one of the great, benefits of something like Bitcoin, right? Where they can't just print it. If you own it, you own it, right? They can't undermine it. They can't print it out from under you, I guess. You know, we just don't know which way all this is going to go. Certainly in terms of, manufacturing of goods, which used to be a pretty good job people had, that went offshore, started going offshore in the 70s. And I think part of the reason was monetary. If you have a situation where the dollar becomes the reserve currency and then countries need that reserve currency, they have to export to us to get dollars, right? We started exporting dollars rather than goods. And that's tough because if you're not in that financial area, where you're benefiting from that, how do you make a good living? I don't know exactly what the right answer is. I think I'd be very nervous about taking on a lot of debt,
right?
With education, even though education can will probably lead to higher earnings, that the level of debt that you have to take on is massive now. So that's a very tough one. I think young people should be continuing to look into these new assets like Bitcoin and putting a little bit of money into them because, it may not work, but you've got a pretty big upside, right? If our financial system shifts and we end up with using something else as the world's reserve currency, it's going to be worth a lot more money, right? So you have, an asymmetric bet you can make where, Bitcoin can go from 10,000 to zero, can't go any lower than zero, but it could also go from 10,000 to a very, very much larger number.
Right. I think I saw this week those Dogecoin. I don't know if you saw that. Dogecoin was rising and going parabolic, and then the TikTokers were talking about, and they were young kids. I think they're like 11, 12 years old, and they're talking about Doge and they're like, it's a cryptocurrency. And what do you make of all that kind of craziness that's going on? I saw it and I was just excited. I was like, wow, they're into cryptocurrency. Wait until they find the deflationary assets out there.
Right, right. I know. Doge is really always kind of funny, right? Because, it shoots up and everyone gets excited about it. And then it kind of fades away and drops back down. I mean, over the long term, has it really ever gone anywhere? I think it just has these pops and then it just, settles back down.
Right.
I mean, meanwhile, you have, least real projects that people are trying to build. Obviously not all of them will be successful. What I think a lot of people don't realize is if you look at, for instance, the stock market over the last, say, 90 or 100 years, the most common outcome for a new stock is to go to zero. That's actually happens more often to a new company that issues its stock than any other thing. It's not the majority of the time. It's just the more common outcome. And most of the returns, I think it's something like half of the returns in the stock market over 95 years come from, I think it's about 80 companies out of something like 25,000 companies that were founded over that period. And so when I look at, you know, all these new, you know, all the new cryptos, all these new assets, and a lot of them fail, it's like, well, okay, that is actually what you'd expect. You'd expect a few winners, right? You'd expect your, you know, Bitcoin clearly in a different category, but you'd expect to, you know, maybe Ethereum works, maybe Chainlink works, maybe one of these, you know, some of these work. But I would expect that the majority of them will fall by the wayside. So I hope these kids aren't borrowing money to do this, you know, so if it doesn't work out, they're not looking at trying to figure out how to dig out of that hole.
Yeah. I just hope Robinhood starts adding more digital assets here. Some more of those 2 cent ones.
Right. I saw you, you'd had a talk about some of these the other day. Are there any that you're looking at right
now? Oh yeah, definitely. There's quite a few. I think, and actually was going to write a post about it this weekend. I was going to go into decentralized storage. I feel like that's something that people aren't looking at right now. If you look at some of the Coinbase stuff that they released here on their blog and what's coming out, about three out of the 7 or 10 of those coins are decentralized storage. So I think what we're going to see here probably later this year, probably early next year, you'll start seeing more talk of Web3 and decentralized storage and how we're going to do that. And there's only like a handful of those projects out there. So I definitely see, and this is probably, I should say this because we're in a main topic, is this is definitely not financial advice, but I definitely see those being reaching a higher price at some point. And if you look at right now, a lot of these are backed by Andreessen Horowitz. They're backed by some of the big companies in the space. And we saw when you're backed by that much liquidity, you're going to get a nice return just riding on the surfboard of these waves. So we saw that happen with Comp. And so I definitely think there's something brewing there. And so that's something I was going to write up and talk about here on the subscription side of our podcast. But yeah, that's the only thing I'm kind of looking at right now is just that. And it's weird too, because you'll see like Vitalik talk about some of these projects. And when he does it, I really, my ears perk up because I'm like, wait, what project are you talking about? Loopring? And then I'll go and look and find out what they're doing, watch some of the developers talk about Loopring and how they can do this batch processing on chain and how it's going to, you know, span across multiple blockchains. And you start realizing like, oh, wow. So not only is Vitalik noticing a project like this is going to have tremendous outcome to the Ethereum ecosystem, but it also is going to impact other blockchains if they go the trajectory they're headed. And I think there's several different blockchains out there that could do that, projects that can do that. It's just knowing which ones can and can't. And I think that takes more of a technology kind of mindset to understand that. And luckily I have one of those. So I think I see it a little more clear because I work day to day with engineers here in Austin. So I understand I can understand like what they're talking about, kind of read in between the lines when they say, oh yeah, we should have something shipped here. You know, I could hear like my coworker say that and I'm like, dude, you're nowhere near completion, are you?
Well, you know, what's funny is I remember in the first, you know, internet boom back in 99, 2000, they just put .com in the end of the company's name and it would go up. And I literally remember being in Chicago on the trading floor, and I think it was KTEL. I don't know if you remember what KTEL was. They had this is really, really ancient stuff, but they used to have ads on TV where they would put together a bunch of songs. So songs of the 60s, songs of the 70s. They'd create these albums and they'd sell them over the phone. So you get a phone number on there, you call in and buy the album, right? So this is ancient technology. So I think it was 98 or 99, they said they were going to become an internet company and they were going to start selling it, instead of just TV, late night TV ads, they're going to sell it over the internet. Now, this doesn't mean they were selling songs in a digital format. This didn't mean MP3s. This just meant you're buying a physical album, but over your computer. And in those days, the vast majority of people had dial-up. So instead of picking up a phone and buying an album, you were plugging a computer into the phone and buying an album. And when they did that, the stock, I think it quadrupled almost overnight because they said they were going to happen. So it was just froth and craziness and, you know, nothing really there. But then it all fell apart. And then over the next few years, people started building real companies and people started building things that actually changed things. And you think about how much of your life is online now and how much, you know, how much the internet did change things. It just didn't change it with that first batch. So I kind of look at what happened in late 2017, where you had a lot of stuff come out. You had a bunch of ICOs. A bunch of this stuff was, you know, either fraudulent or bad ideas or people not planning it all the way through. But now it's been a few years and people are starting to realize what you can really do, right? Right. And so I think the real world changing stuff is probably coming out. You know, in the next year or two, right? Now we're going to get the real companies and the real people are going to change the way we, you know, live our lives and do business.
Right. And we just talked about Chainlink this week. It's funny that you brought that up. And I've been watching a lot of talks with Sergey. He's the founder of Chainlink, very bright guy. And so when he talks about, you know, where these projects are headed, Chainlink did a really interesting thing. I think most people do not really understand. When it came out initially, he was already waiting with his hand out, like, you're going to need this, right? Looking at the Ethereum ecosystem. And at the time, no one saw that, where that puck was going, right? And so they not only were they first in line, but he really saw where that was headed. So whenever I hear him talk, I listen. And so what he's talking about these days is more about infrastructure and projects and how they're building infrastructure right now for Ethereum and some of these other ecosystems. And so if you're going to look at this, and he doesn't say this part, this is where I'm saying this part. If you look at this ecosystem and seeing how it's being built out, you kind of want to make a play on some of these infrastructure projects, right? Not all of them are going to be bullseye, but what he did with Chainlink is total infrastructure play. And right now, that's where the phase we're in. We're building out these railroads. We're building out these tunnel systems. And eventually, once that gets built, then it's just, you know, second layer, third layer, fourth layer. And then it just becomes, you know, amazing, you know, developers and talented creatives that can go out there and change the world. So I think right now, I think I'm looking more at these kind of infrastructure projects and seeing them as being the most potential for gains, I think. But that's for another podcast.
And there's still a lot of talent flooding into the space, which is just amazing, right? Definitely. That's kind of probably the best long-term indicator. There's a lot of really bright people going into this area, and that hasn't really slowed down, I don't think.
Yeah, and even in what I do here in IT and Austin, I have like co-workers now are like willing to talk about cryptocurrency, but it wasn't like that, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, if even. I think what happened this year definitely has spurred that, made people look at digital money differently. But I think that's all I got. What do you guys got going on there today at Grace Swan? Anything coming out?
So, I mean, right now we're just kind of trying to get awareness of the concept out there. We expect to be doing something probably 6 to 12 months. You'll be hearing more. But our goal is to transform the 100-year-old and $500 trillion derivatives industry the way Apple transformed the computer a long time ago by making this intuitive and graphical and visual so that the transfer of risks from one person to another and the trading of derivatives is something that people can understand and trade in a safer way. So that's awesome. that's what we've been working on, trying to create a system that's safer, more human friendly, easier for people to use, and that can actually help people and companies manage their risk and make better investments. So that we've been working on that for a couple of years now, and we should be releasing something. Again, 6 to 12 months is probably the likely timeline. So right now we're just going out and talking and trying to get people aware of that concept, which is kind of a slow process, but we'll get there.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I wish you the best, Peter. If there's anything that we could ever do for you here on Thriller Crypto, feel free to reach out. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's get on to the end of the show.
It's Dunsies. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you to Peter Harrigan for coming on the show. I appreciate you. Also, if you guys want to check out more of what we do here at Thriller Crypto, head over to ThrillerX.com, ThrillerX.com, and subscribe to all our stuff there. Free newsletter, past episodes, over 350 of them. And yeah, we'll be releasing some more stuff this week. Buy Bitcoin, save the entire world. See you next time.
This is the end.